Zeppelin.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is Led Zeppelin.
Messrs. Bonham, Jones, Page, and Plant. Led Zeppelin.
Ladies and gentlemen, the American return of Led Zeppelin.
Welcome back, everybody, for season three of the Zepp Fan All Things Led Zeppelin podcast. My name is Mark McFall, and you are listening to episode 24. This is the first episode of 2024, so for those of you into numbers, hopefully that's a good thing. Episode 24, year 2024. We have a lot of great things in store for you this year, so please stay tuned. First thing, we did have some inquiries about some Zepp Fan t-shirts and merchandise, so I'm happy to say that we do now have Zepp Fan t-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and we have a whole store of some Zeppelin-related products. So please check out our Etsy store at Zepp Fan Store. That's going to be all one word. I'm sure when you search it, we probably won't be the first shirt, but you'll see the Zepp Fan t-shirts on there. Select there, and you could view our store. We're also on eBay, so you could search Zepp Fan Store there. And our YouTube channel. We're now on YouTube Music for our podcast, and also on my YouTube channel, Mark Zepp. You could listen to our podcast there. So when we update podcasts, they'll automatically update on the YouTube channel. That's a great start to 2024, I must say. So stay tuned. There's going to be a lot more things. Let's talk about our guest today. Our next guest is Mike Tramaglio. He is co-author of the incredible, comprehensive book, Evenings with Led Zeppelin. He co-authored this book with Dave Lewis. This mammoth coffee-sized book is over 620 pages and weighs over 5 pounds. The book chronicles more than 500 Led Zeppelin appearances, starting from Denmark 1968 all the way through to their last gig with Jimmy, Robert, John Paul, and Bonham in Berlin on July 7th, 1980. It's a great read, very comprehensive. So if you want the facts, you want to know what they did, when they did it, and how they did it, read the book. It's awesome. There's two editions. Mike's going to talk about those today as well. Mike is the archivist. So he was the one doing all the research for every aspect of every Led Zeppelin show. He's been doing this for decades. His meticulous research through the years led to many concert facts, which he will share with us. He has been researching every aspect of Led Zeppelin for decades. His meticulous research through the years have led to many discoveries, which will be pretty cool because he's going to share those with us today. His hobby as an archivist led him to author many stories through the incredible fanzine Proximity. And then, of course, he's really known for his retrospective articles in Dave Lewis's Tight Belouse, and which later led him to co-author this book with none other than the King of Led Zeppelin, Dave Lewis. So I'm happy he's here today. We're going to dive into some Zeppelin as always. Here we go. Our upcoming guest is a leading archivist of Led Zeppelin, dedicating over 4 decades to researching the band. He's widely known for sharing his work online and in print, most notably his retrospectives in Dave Lewis's Tight Belouse magazine. His collaboration with Dave Lewis resulted in the comprehensive book, Evenings with Led Zeppelin, The Complete Concert Chronicle. Join us as Mike Tramaglio shares his journey and intense passion for chronicling every aspect of Led Zeppelin's career. Mike, welcome to Zepp Fan Podcast. How's everything going today?
Everything's great, Mark. Really pleasure to be here and looking forward to our discussion.
Right. Well, let's definitely talk some Zeppelin. Before we start, where are you located at?
I'm located in Connecticut, central Connecticut, right 2 hours from New York and 2 hours from Boston.
Oh, well, very cool. Well, let's dive right into the Zeppelin aspect of it. I mean, you've been collecting for, you know, decades, just like myself. I mean, what got you into Zeppelin in the first place? And what year was that?
What really got me into Zeppelin was when my brother purchased House of the Holy right after it came out. He's 4 years older than me. And at the time, you know, I was more into the singles thing, you know, when you're a little kid.
Right.
And I don't know, reason, yeah. Like a lot of other Americans, I guess, Houses of the Holy really, really hit home. And we played that album morning, noon, and night. So, you know, it was after the 73 tour that I really started hearing it. But I loved that album a lot. And then, you know, when they started touring in 75, we were really interested in trying to get tickets, but we failed in 75. So that was a disappointment. But that's when the whole journey started in terms of, you know, looking at all the old magazines. And
right.
We followed the tours closely. And I remember when Physical Graffiti came out, we we called every record store in the area to try to figure out which one would get it first the day it was released. It's funny because the first song I heard off the album was on an AM station of all things.
Wow.
And it was Custard Pie. Yeah, it was Custard Pie. And it was about a week before it came out. And then, but that was really the spark that really started everything. I mean, I had heard Whole Lot of Love when I was a real small kid. And I loved that, of course. Who didn't, right? And, but how Physical Graffiti was a thing, you know, between House of the Holy and Physical Graffiti, it really kicked off the whole, you know, years of enjoyment.
The first time you saw them is 1977?
Correct. Yeah, just like your other guest, Tony Pauline, I saw the June
1977
show.
And how old were you at that show?
I was 16 in Central Connecticut. It was a pretty big deal. And it's funny because I remember I was in high school gym class, and a guy who knew I loved Led Zeppelin, he was a guy who was a year ahead of me. In fact, I don't even remember his name. But he said, "Hey, Mike, check this out." And he had the full page ad from the day before New York Times up to actually get me a copy. And he gave it to me. And immediately when I got home, me and my older brother and four of his friends, we got a money order. If we figured if we did a money order, we'll have better chances of scoring tickets. So so we sent that in and hoped like hell that we'd get tickets to the show. And when, you know, a few weeks later, I get this envelope, and it's funny because it was my handwriting. I was kind of confused by it. I don't know why. I just must have forgotten. And then I'm like, all of a sudden, I'm like, I remember, hey, that's my handwriting. These must be the tickets. And it was exciting. So, yeah, that was the first time we saw them. And, you know, convincing my parents took a little bit of effort, but, you know, they understood how important it was to us. So what they did is they made a night of it in New York City. They let us go to the show, and it was a memory for a lifetime.
Speaking of memories, I mean, what do you recall from that show? Was that your first concert, or is that the first big concert you've seen?
No, it wasn't my first concert. My first concert was in 1975. I saw Johnny Winter in Waterbury, Connecticut. The Ramones, the first concert they ever played outside New York City, opened for Johnny Winter, and they were pelted. Everything with whiskey bottles and you name it, everything was thrown at them, and they had to leave the stage after like 15 minutes. But that was my first, you know, I was a big Johnny Winter fan at that time. And, you know, also saw a few other acts at the New Haven Coliseum, which was a pretty popular venue back in the day.
Oh, good. And so what memories do you have of the show?
The memories I have more than anything, and in fact, I actually had written a review of the show for Hugh Jones's Proximity magazine. The thing I remember the show is they were about an hour and a half late. And it was crazy. The audience was just, it was like a powder keg ready to explode. Everybody was so excited to see him. Because don't forget, at that point in time too, everybody had seen The Song Remains the Same. Or they were anticipating what they were gonna get in concert.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when they finally hit the stage, and, you know, you heard the first chords of The Song Remains the Same. It was incredible. It was so exciting, and it really lived up to the expectation.
Very cool. How many times did you see Song Remains the Same before the concert?
I would guess that I probably saw it maybe three or four times, but I remember seeing it on opening night at the theater in downtown. We went the opening night to see The Song Remains the Same. And of course, it was such a thrill for us because we were such big fans. And as you know, even back then, it was pretty difficult in 1975 to find any bootlegs of Led Zeppelin. There weren't too many to be had. And quite frankly, the only one I could really remember even hearing on the radio at that point in time was they played the BBC from 1971 in 1975 on the radio.
Well, that puts you at 16 in 1977. At what point did you realize, you know, I'm more than just liking Led Zeppelin? I'm a Zepp fan where I just want to documenting everything.
Well, the one thing I was always interested in history in general, and I was always interested in music. So it kind of combined the two things. And my brain works. Everything I remember through dates. I store every date. So I have a really good memory for dates, and it allows me to basically keep everything stored the way I need to recall it. And So what I really got into was between all the magazines, all the music that I could get, I just kept on building and building and building a whole backlog of information on the band. The one thing I think that really sets Led Zeppelin off from a lot of other bands that has the, you know, this kind of loyalty and fandom is the fact that there are so many bootlegs that are so so different. Whereas, you know, you see some of the other bands, in fact, some of my other favorite bands, they play pretty much the same set list every night, pretty much the same way. There isn't too much improvisation. Whereas with Zeppelin, you could literally take two nights in a row and have a completely different listening experience from one night to the next. And I think that that's really what drove my interest in the band was, you know, rather than just getting one bootleg from a particular tour and playing it and enjoying it, you could really see and hear the differences night by night, which was always, you know, made you want to get that next bootleg.
Yeah, I totally agree. And especially the earlier years or even later, I mean, it doesn't matter, but everything, it's always different, especially, you know, you listen to 69, they toured so crazy and from night to night, it was just always different. They just played to whatever felt good. And I thought that was the coolest thing about them.
Absolutely. And I think between the books that were released on the band, whether it's Dave Lewis, my buddy Dave Lewis's old books, or whether it was Howard Mylett or even Richie York, and then all through the years, it seems like everybody kept that torch alive, because even with the culmination of our book, you know, so many people came before us and really laid it down as well. And, you know, you look and see how many people, you know, produce fanzines, like such as yourself. I know you did the No Quarter, which I was a subscriber about.
Thank you.
Dave's Type of Loose. You have Sam Rapallo's Electric Magic. Dave Taylor's Zoso. You have, you know, Hugh Jones's Proximity, I thought was phenomenal.
Yep.
So many people added to the whole, you know, my love for the history of the band, because I really couldn't get enough about reading about their concerts, reading about the band, and so many people brought so much to the table. Oh, also, another one was Early Days, Latter Days by Andy Adams.
Mm-hmm. Grant Burgess, the new one. Yeah,
Grant Burgess, yeah.
The Lemon Tree. I mean, there, it goes on. It's amazing because as I started putting together my website, you know, I love fanzines. I always have, even before I did one. I just thought there was something really amazing about someone's passion to want to share Led Zeppelin with others and putting it in print. Yeah, as I started putting it together, my website, then I had a fanzine section, and I started finding there's just so many fanzines. Especially what always surprised me was there's one from Japan, the Thank You, that, you know, they have the Thank You research book. And I always just thought that was a book, but that was actually a fanzine, I suppose, before they compiled it into a book. And that went back to, I think, 75 or 76. So it's pretty amazing that, you know, there's fans all over the world just dedicated to the band, just want to share their love and share articles and just express what they feel for the band with others. So it's a really unique feeling for sure.
I think one of the things that really why the fanzines played such an important role is, especially pre-internet days, is because when the interest in Zeppelin waned, they really kept the flame alive. And the funny thing is, when you space them out, you know, you could you literally could hop from one fanzine to the next that always kept that I had going, which was great, you know, because I would read the fanzines, couldn't wait to get the next one. And
right.
There are so many different periods of time where something new came along that provided an infusion to the whole love of Zep, whether it was, you know, obviously when Zeppelin released the box set in 1990, then you have the internet coming along, which made a huge difference. Of course, all the CDs, which came out like beginning in the early 90s, that also fueled a lot of interest. So it always seems like there's something to keep it going, which is great. I mean, even, you know, it's 2024, we're still talking about it 44 years later.
Yeah, and who would have thought? And I agree with you. And especially from 80 to almost the late 80s, you know, there was like no interest in Zep at all. The music was changing quite a bit, but there was just no interest in Led Zeppelin. But for fans like us, there's always that interest. And I agree with you. I think the bootlegs, the fanzines really kept everything going. Do you collect? Are you a memorabilia collector as well?
I'm actually not a particularly big collector. I mean, I have some, I have, you know, I know my wife would probably disagree with me on that one, but
yep.
All the official, of course. And I have a ton of magazines. I have a ton of fanzines. I don't collect too. I mean, I have a handbill from like the Olympia, the Cancer Olympia show in 1969. One of my favorite pieces of memorabilia is my actual ticket stub, which is, you know, I got the whole word Zeppelin in there, which is good because I know a lot of times they ripped it too far. But I also have an ad, another ad from the New York Times that I got the tickets for, but it was a different one that I got than the one I use, obviously. And so little things here and there. I have a lot of Melody Makers, a lot of New Musical Expresses, discs. Mainly focused on publications as opposed to memorabilia. Although thankfully, because of Dave Lewis, he got me both Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones's autographs when they signed type that I had written articles for.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, I would imagine. Okay, so you're not a memorabilia collector, but I would imagine bootlegs played a huge part. I'm sure you collected quite a bit of bootlegs back in the day as well.
I have a ton of bootlegs. Oh yeah. You know, between, you know, official CD releases and, you know, obviously all the easy downloads, but it's funny because in the early 90s, I had a friend from California. His name was Lyman Munson, who was a big, big Zeppelin collector. He had all the shows on cassette. And he was one of the first guys that really had such a comprehensive collection. And for probably a good 7 years, we would mail back and forth, you know, the whole snail mail thing.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, from there, it went from all the cassette tapes to CD. And then it just became on your hard drive at that point. Right. I'm familiar with all the bootlegs. I have all of them. And
yeah. What I love about live collectors, the fact that we all have our own terminology when we speak to each other, it's like, oh, you know, because it's all in code. Oh, what do you think of 110.69? Or did you listen to the new source of 427.69? Or, you know what I mean? It's always like this code that we always say. We don't say the full name. It's always the code or the date. And then you always know someone else is a hardcore collector when they're like, oh, yeah, I heard that. Did you hear this one? So I've always been fascinated by that.
Yeah, no question about it. I literally have every Zeppelin concert date off the top of my head.
Well, let's dive into this archiving because I think – before I touch base on the book, so you mentioned you're into dates and all that. Did you just start just with a simple spreadsheet and just write what you know, like Circus Magazine came out. I saw Led Zeppelin in Madison Square. They played 6 shows. I mean, how did that work to all of a sudden you're like gathering information? I would imagine going to your local library to get more information and asking people for stuff. I mean, how did that drive you to want to just get the wealth of information you have that led to, you know, publishing a book?
I think one of the key things for me was I always read a lot. I always, you know, between the bootlegs, I always made spreadsheets. You know, obviously I was into Excel and had all the live information on spreadsheets. Next thing you know, what I did was I put together all these spreadsheets. And in fact, it ended up, you know, going to Dave, you know, many years ago, but I sent a bunch of them to Dave. But what I did was I put for each concert date, I would put the concert recording, the set list. I put all the bootleg information and I'd separate them all onto separate pages based on date. So I was probably compiling this stuff beginning in the early 90s, probably about 91 or two. And I think 1991 was the year Lewis Ray's book came out, which was, you know, that was another shot in the arm, I think, for fan, because he did a great job on that book and brought all the concert recordings that we were trying to acquire, and he really set a target for us to go seek out these recordings. And I think that was a turning point in terms of you know, helping everybody out understand all about the Zeppelin concert history. And between compiling all this information and then working with some of the fanzines. For example, like I mentioned before, that I used to get Proximity Magazine, and then I helped with an article from the show I went to. But there was a lot of information in that magazine that I took out and, you know, I put aside on my spreadsheet. Same thing with Type It Loose, of course. Dave was always very comprehensive in terms of covering Zeppelin. Let's face it, Dave was the flag bearer when the years were pretty lean. Mm-hmm. It seemed like there weren't too many Zeppelin fans left. He always kept the flame going. And so every time something new came along and the interest sparked, it seems like, you know, more information came out. And then what ended up happening was once the internet hit, that changed everything.
Oh.
That's when I really got into it a lot, because you're able to acquire so much more information. And then, you know, when you go down the line, what really made probably the biggest difference was all the newspaper archives that were finally making its way online. Because that actually a lot later than you would think, you know. And what really sparked interest with Type It Loose and contributing to that was in about almost 20 years ago now, Dave Lewis had sent out a little note saying he was updating the concert file that he had done with Simon Pallett, and requested if anybody has any information, could they provide it? And needless to say, I sent him a huge list of material, and he really appreciated it. And then Dave was very supportive and encouraging and asked if I wanted to write for Type It Loose magazine. And that was an easy yes. And
yeah,
as you mentioned before, for many, many years, I did comprehensive tour retrospectives, usually anniversary based, whether it's the 40th anniversary of a show or whatever. But for many years, I did that. For many years, I was a writer, editor, and handyman for Type It Loose. You know,
very cool. In the years of research that you've done, or decades, I should say, what are some of the things you are most proud of, or that you found like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they played here, or I can't believe this happened?
A few of them. One of them was I had never seen it before, and I saw the show for February 16th, 1969, which was at the Baltimore Civic Center, because prior to that, and even in a lot of news reports, the last date of the tour was February 14th.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty excited because I hadn't seen that on any list or anywhere before. So that was pretty cool. And another one that was more than a decade in the making. And in fact, even on the official site, a lot of people had contributed to a post about Led Zeppelin playing Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was about 12 years when I finally was able to track down the exact date that show was played. And it was on August 7th, 1969. And I ended up finding it in, I think it was a Las Vegas Sun newspaper.
Wow.
Whenever I did searches, I always made sure I spelled the name wrong. And when you know, they had spelled the name Led Zeppelin wrong. But it said Led Zeppelin's, the article was basically the curfew for tonight's show has been extended because for the Led Zeppelin concert. So finally, after all that time, you know, people had gone to the Las Vegas library to look for that date, and everybody tried to remember it. And so that was one. A lot of dates that I was able to track down were either confirming canceled shows or coming up with more canceled shows. Like, for example, the Northern California Rock Festival.
Yep.
For many, many years, people thought they had played that when they didn't play it. And, you know, so there are a lot of things I was able to track down, and you know, it's always exciting when you find another piece of the puzzle to add to everybody else's.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. You know, and it seems like in '69, the way they did stuff, they just kind of toured the states, jumped in the car, and you know, if they have a free day, they'd find out where they could play in town, and just they'd play. So it's a lot of that stuff, I think it would be on the whim, where it's not really well documented unless it's put into paper just as a blurb.
It was kind of difficult tracking a lot of this stuff down because I always wanted to go to the original source rather than the secondary source. And obviously, you know, a review of a concert in the next day's paper is about as good as you're going to get, because that way the concert was played and you know, yeah, when and where it was played. So that was always good. But another game changer for me in terms of, you know, documenting the whole band's touring history was about 15 years ago, I found out that there was this underground newspaper archive on microfilm. And they were only in a handful of libraries in the United States. There were 500 rolls of microfilm, and they had newspapers. Now, this is way before any of these ended up on the internet. And I thought one of them was about 15 minutes from my house at a university. So I went over there probably about, you know, 5 weeks in a row and, you know, looked through all these underground reels of new, and I found a ton of material. And it was so exciting because I was finding all this information that really was under wraps for so many years. And I thought that was a big game changer for me.
Yeah, I could imagine. And I always thought was interesting too, just speaking of just dates that happened, the San Diego March 14th show said to only be March 10th, but then Empress Valley released a bootleg that was March 14th, and that was really never documented. So was that a surprise to you as well?
It was a surprise when it came out. But what's even more surprising is how much documentation there actually was on. That was really funny because for some reason it was only March 10th that got out, but March 14th was there all along. And in fact, there's so many different newspaper references to it. But that just goes to show, you know, what a game changer having all those old newspapers on finally online made, because then you can really put all the pieces of the Zep puzzle together.
Yeah. And so I imagine you save photos too. Anything you come across, you document the photos and save those?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Really interested in all along too is I was always fascinated with the venues where they played.
Mm-hmm.
But when I did the tour retrospectives for Type of Loose, I always wanted to have the venue pictures in there too, because that way you could see where they play, you see the ticket stub, you see the bootleg recording. So anybody could look at it and really get a feel for the whole show, what it was about, where it was played, and try to get a feel for the whole environment. And that was important to me, especially with the book, to get in all the venue photos, which, let me tell you, that's a small task trying to track down all those.
Yeah, I could imagine.
It's funny because just before we released the first book, for so many years, I was trying to track down this a photo of the Oakdale Music Theater, which is in Wallingford, Connecticut, not too far from me. I know now it's a completely different theater, but at the time, it was kind of like the Music Carnival in Cleveland. It was a tent, a musical tent theater, where it was, you know, theater in the round, you know, and the stage spun. But I can never find a photo of the original theater. And the funny thing is, probably about a week before it was ready to go to press, I was looking on archive.org and I saw a travelogue book from 1957, and it had a great picture of the Oakdale Music Theater in there. So we snuck that in there at the last second. And it actually had more of a meaning to me because my first ever concert, not rock concert, but first ever concert was a month before Zeppelin's concert there. And it was Tom Jones, believe it or not. I saw Tom Jones at the
nice
theater. And a few weeks later, my cousin Angela went to see Led Zeppelin at the Oakdale. And at the time, it was a disappointment to her because the reason why she got tickets is because her father wouldn't let her go to Woodstock. Wow. That was her consolation prize, which wasn't too bad a prize at all, was it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, on the topic of photos, and that's the beauty of the internet now, there's just such a wealth of photos. Because I remember when I started with Led Zeppelin in the early 80s, you know, there was just a couple books. We had nearly no pictures of 1980 tour. This was like kind of the unicorn tour back then because we didn't have pictures of it. There was a Circus magazine, I think, that had a calendar or a foldout of a 1980 shot of Jimmy and Robert, but that was kind of it. And now, I mean, with the internet, everything's popping up, all these photos all over the place. You know, I used to think, you know, oh, I saw that photo, but now there's so many of them. I'm like, did I see that one? Have I seen that one before? So it's really cool. What was the last photo you came across that new to you?
That's a tough one.
They're always coming out, right? I mean, you know, anything on the internet, there's always something new, especially 77, I would imagine. And that's the hard one too, because they're always kind of wearing the same costumes.
Yeah. What's tricky with 77 too, especially for, you know, I was kind of excited because a few years ago, Dave Lewis collaborated on a book, 1975 and 1977 photograph book.
Great book.
And Terry O'Neill a famous photographer took pictures of the Zeppelin show from June 7, 77. And I was really happy because that was the only show he took. So I know that every photo from that
right.
was that night and not the other five shows, you know? So that was encouraging to see. Because most of them, the New York's kind of a mess. The only one you could kind of separate out is like the last show, Jimmy Page didn't wear, he wore plain white pants. So if you see New York white pants, you know, it's the last night of the New York run, which was 6/14.
Right.
Funny thing is, my wife had actually seen him the night before, 6/13/77, a few years before I met her.
Oh, cool. Very cool.
You know, it amazes me how many still pop up. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, you'll see it. Especially on Facebook, you'll see somebody post a photo, and you're like, wow, I haven't seen that before. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I agree. Well, let's dive into the book, because, I mean, this book is stellar. I mean, not only it weighs a ton, so you know it's going to be a great read. I mean, it's, what is it, 600 plus pages?
Yes.
Gosh, I'm just overwhelmed, because I remember when I first got the book, I started reading it, put on my reading glasses, and you're listening to it, and all you want to do is like, oh, I want to hear that concert now. I want to hear it. And, you know, you're only in March 69, but, you know, all of a sudden I'm diving into every 69 show there is, and I just grew a new passion for it too, from your book. But talk about this book. I mean, how did the book come about? How long did it take?
Well, thanks for the kind words, first of all. I really appreciate it, because that really was what the intention was. You know, we wanted to put a comprehensive book together that really united the whole, you know, Zep community. Because, you know, there are so many different pieces of this book where so many people had a contribution to. They really, whether it's whether it's newspaper articles, whatever, but so many people contributed to their book, to the book, and so many people were so helpful. And so we both really appreciated that. But, you know, in terms of how long it took a long, long, long time. I mean, one thing that helped us tremendously was from the years of doing all those tour retrospectives for Tight But Loose gave us a nice head start. Because, you know, kickstarted the whole thing, and that really was the genesis of the book. But when I would say, in terms of, you know, compiling it seriously, probably I'll bet it took a good solid 4 to 5 years to pull it off. It was a lot of work. I mean, just tracking down all the memorabilia, even cleaning up all the images, because I did all that, cleaning up all the images and you know, getting all the photographs and doing all the research. It took a long time, but, you know, we really felt in the end that it was worth it.
Right. The feeling once it was printed and getting it into your hands, I could imagine, because I've done, you know, a fanzine, and I've done a couple books, and I just know that feeling when you get it. I mean, you must have been just like through the roof on just getting this thing in your hands once it's printed, having that fresh print smell on the pages. I mean, what was that like?
It's funny you mention that, Mark, because it was supposed to be released on September 7th of 2018, which would have, by the way, been the 50th anniversary of Zeppelin's first concert. However, there was a delay with the printer. And I had gone to London for the book release. And I landed my first day in London, first time I met Dave in person too. Even though we had 5,000, FaceTime calls through the year, maybe not 5,000, but a lot.
Probably 5,000.
It was a lot. We talked constantly about it in emails and all that. So it was great to meet him. But that day, the day that I met him, I met him in London, and he calls it his second office, the Spice of Life pub. I met him, and that's the first time I saw the book. And at the time, that was literally the only book.
Wow.
Because it came out like about 2 weeks after that. So we only had one copy of the book when I got there. And, but when he showed it to me, it really was such a thrill. It, you know, the whole experience going to London, meeting so many great people, you know, all the guys we had spoke about before, whether it's Lewis Ray and Andy Adams and so many of those guys over there, Julian Walker. I mean, I hate to forget anybody's name. The good people, and they were all so welcoming, and it was a real thrill. We were there for a week. Me and my wife went over there, and it was a lot of fun. We had a good time. Dave sponsored an event on one of the last days I was there, and it was at the Atlas Pub, and it was kind of like a mini convention. Now, there were probably a good 50 people there. There were all the Zeppelin diehards and all the people that totally love Zeppelin. And it was probably a good, you know, 5-hour event at least. And, you know, had some videos going on, a lot of talking Zep. It was just such a thrill. But to finally see the book and have it in hand after so much time, effort, blood, sweat, tears, the whole bit, the ups and downs of pulling it off, it was so fulfilling.
It's an amazing feeling, is it? Yeah, I could share it with you because I do know that feeling, and just the wealth and the heaviness of your book. It's just like, oh my gosh, it's done. Here it is. How did you two come up with the name and decide on the cover photo? Which the cover photo is, I mean, that's the epitome of Led Zeppelin, right? 1969, just killing it. When you look at that photo, you could just hear Bonham just slamming away the cymbals, Plant just screaming into the mic. I mean, you could just on all four cylinders when you see that photo, by the way. So, but how did you guys come up with the name in the photo?
Actually, the name Evenings with Led Zeppelin, that was something that was Dave's idea. He always liked the fact that Peter Grant used that as their tagline for their 1970 tour. He always had that in the back of his mind as what would be a good name for a book. And you know, I liked it right away. So that was good. And the photo, in terms of why we chose that particular photo, is I always, you know, Evenings with Led Zeppelin, to me, what that title represented was the connection between Led Zeppelin and the audience. And that's why, you know, when I saw this particular picture, I'm like, this picture, probably more than just about any other, you could really feel that connection with the audience and, mm-hmm. you know, how close they are and how much they're getting into it. And, you know, one little thing, I know that a few people have brought up before, but I, you know, just to come clean on this one, you know, most people that are familiar with those two photos taken by a Time Life photographer, I might add, John Paul Jones was not in that original photo.
Oh.
But the guy took another photo that was very similar to that, but John Paul Jones was in it. So what we did was we could not have a Led Zeppelin book and have three of the four members of Led Zeppelin. So we kind of flew John Paul Jones onto the cover there and placed him really where he was anyway. I mean, if you look at the other photo, you'll see that that's the case. But yeah, that was a little hack, if you will.
A little Photoshop magic there. Yeah, and I agree with you. You always have to have all four of them on the cover. That is awesome. What year did you guys release that?
The actual release date was, I think it was October 14th of 2018.
Oh, time flies.
And then the second one came out in 2021.
Okay.
There are not too many books left. There's probably only a handful left at this point.
And is there plans for a third one?
You never know, Mark.
Leave us. That's like asking Robert Plant if he's going to get back with Led Zeppelin. You guys going to get back? Anything could happen.
Over the last few years, I mean, you think of all the videos that have come out, you know, like whether it's the bath video or all this, obviously more bootlegs have come out. That's a given. But, you know, one thing that's come out is a lot of UK newspaper archives that were not available.
Really?
Yeah. In the last few years, Birmingham, Liverpool, Newcastle, a lot of ads, a lot of articles, a lot of reviews can be added. So I'm hoping that we get another crack at it. We'll keep our fingers crossed on that one.
Right. And if I remember correctly, the second edition had red print on the front, right? And what was it? Just Evenings with Led Zeppelin was in red? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes. Yes, exactly. The second edition had a black cover with Led Zeppelin in red print. The first one had like a the sepia toned Led Zeppelin cover. It's the same picture. You know, we wanted to make sure that people knew that a large portion of it was it was an update and not a brand new book, because we don't want to, you know, we don't want to confuse people either. I also wanted to point out was the revised edition to the first edition. We added a whole section on official, well, I should say unofficial bootleg releases. So listing of all the dates and the titles associated with those dates of all the recordings that, you know, it's a guide so people could take a look and is in the appendix and see that. One thing I wanted to mention too with the revised book is that, you know, Brian Knapp, super collector Brian Knapp, really helped us out tremendously in our revised edition of the book too. He opened up his memorabilia collection. And, you know, I also collaborated with Brian on doing a special record collector Zeppelin collector's edition feature, which was nice.
How many live shows are there?
They did, I think, 517 shows. We have 288 recordings available.
Not a bad percentage.
516 concerts. But the thing to keep in mind, that recordings available, you know, those, you know, that just means that there's still another, you know, few hundred Zeppelin bootlegs out there waiting to be produced. There's a lot of bootlegs out there, that's for sure.
Are there any concerts that you are aware of that you think they played, but you don't have documentation on it?
You know, I really don't think we do. I don't think, you know, I think it's pretty much been exhausted. I know that in the book, I also covered it too, was that gig in Maryland that they said that they played at the Wheaton Community Center there. UK gigs in 68, maybe one or two of them that we had never heard before, perhaps. That's the only thing I could think of that may have been played. I don't, because everything else is pretty much been covered, but you know what? You never know, because every once in a while, something pops up.
So listen, Mike, I can't thank you enough for joining me. I always end the podcast. It sounds like you've listened to a few of them. So I always like to ask a question with a one-word answer or maybe two words. But let me go through this list and then we'll go from there, okay?
Sure.
What is your favorite Led Zeppelin LP?
Disco Graffiti.
What's your least favorite Led Zeppelin LP?
We'll exclude Coda because that's the posthumous release. Enter the Outdoor.
All right. And do you have a favorite Led Zeppelin song?
The Song Remains the Same live version.
From Song Remains the Same soundtrack?
Correct.
Do you have a least favorite song or a song that you just don't care for that much?
Hats off to Roy Harper.
And then Jimmy Page or Robert Plant fan?
John Bonham.
John Bonham, nice. Okay, going off the grid here. Do you have a favorite solo project?
Robert Plant, Manic Nirvana, probably.
Do you feel they should have continued after the O2 show?
Definitely not.
What was your first bootleg you listened to?
First bootleg I ever bought was The Destroyer from 42877 Cleveland, and I got it about 9 months after I saw him.
Oh, very cool. What was the last bootleg you listened to?
It was from March 21st, 1970, the Vancouver show.
Do you have a favorite live show?
My favorite live show that I like the most in terms of just listening to it over and over is, I really like Orlando 1971.
Yeah, the 71 is pretty amazing. Well, listen, Mike, any last words you want to share with fellow Zep fans? Anything you want to promote? Anything else going on? The floor is yours.
Well, a few things I wanted to bring up that I may have overlooked in our initial discussion here is just the fact that I was really grateful to Sam Rapallo on the official website, who, you know, I've provided a lot of material through the years, and also one of the things he allowed me to do is I provided a lot to the Super Deluxe box sets, and also the BBC box set that, you know, Dave Lewis and I did the liner notes on for the remastered deluxe box sets in 2015. So that was a real thrill. And that goes along the lines of, you know, the research through the years that I was able to get involved with. Hopefully we'll continue to get some new music out of Zeppelin in one form or another, whether it's bootlegs, whether it's videos. I mean, it was interesting to see that Pontiac video that just came out a few weeks ago. That came out of the blue, which was kind of nice. So, you never know what's going to pop up. But one thing's for sure is I'm sure we'll be all over it when it does.
Very good. All right, Mike. Well, thanks again. You enjoy your day.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mark. Take it easy. Have a good one.
Well, there you have it. Mike Tramaglio. That was cool. Man, I have to say, after doing that interview, I have so many more questions than I do answers now. there's like a lot of things I want to find out more about his research and some concerts and some certain eras of Led Zeppelin. So hopefully he comes back for another part two, because it's always great talking to him. And then, you know, thanks again, everyone. Thank you for listening to the podcast. I thank you. Until the next episode, peace, love, and Led Zeppelin. Good night.